You're listening to Truth and Justice Radio, 4 hours of spirited resistance to war, injustice, lying politicians, jingoism, and corporate disinformation. And we're just heading into the final hour of those 4 hours. If I didn't say this before, playlist will soon be available at WZBC.org. And now, welcome to This Week in Palestine with Sharif Pham. Hello, Sharif.
Hello, Stan. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly half-hour segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, were you involved last week in the Israel-Palestine peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's occupation of their land? Did you speak out on the atrocities being committed by Israel in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? It is Sunday, July 16th, 2006, and the news are not good. The carnage in Gaza continues. A modern army, arguably the third or fourth most powerful military in the world, equipped with supersonic jet fighters, helicopter gunships, tanks, artillery, and naval gunboats, is attacking an imprisoned civilian population under siege, destroying its civil society and everything that sustains it. That basic reality continues to be ignored by the media in this country, which focuses its reports on the Israeli soldier captured during a military raid and the primitive Qassam rockets fired at Israeli towns in retaliation for Israel's killing of Palestinian civilians. The response to an action is again being used to justify the action itself. We have heard this clever time reversal trick being used again and again to justify the action. Yet there is no justification for the savagery of a modern army attacking an imprisoned civilian population under siege. Simply put, such a military attack by a sovereign state on a civilian population is nothing short of massive state terrorism and murder. More than 80 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli army in the last 3 weeks. All of that for the capture of one Israeli soldier. There is no mention of the more than 10,000 Palestinian civilians Israel is holding in its prisons, nor of the fact that the night before the soldier was captured, Israel abducted a Palestinian doctor and his brother from their home in Gaza. When asked for his response to the carnage in Gaza, President Bush cited Israel's right to defend itself. Indeed. The INN World Report broadcast a report on Wednesday stating that the Palestinian Ministry of Health has reported that the Israelis appear to be using a new type of explosive in their military campaign in Gaza. The explosive contains toxics and radioactive material, which burn and tear the victim's body from the inside. The ministry has called upon the international community and humanitarian organizations to send an international team of experts to examine the victims and ascertain the truth about the weapons Israel appears to be using. Dr. Juma al-Sakka of the Shifa Hospital in Gaza told Al Jazeera that, quote, even bodies of the injured have been almost completely burned. They have been deformed in a very ugly way that we have never seen before. And he added, quote, when we try to x-ray dead bodies, we find no trace of the shrapnel which hit the person killed. The bodies seem to have been chemically burned, unquote. Presumably, chemical burning of a body from the inside would also burn away any plastic shrapnel, wiping out all evidence of their penetration and the type of ordnance used. Also on Wednesday, an explosive situation developed in Lebanon when Hezbollah attacked an Israeli patrol along the border between Israel and Lebanon, killing 6 soldiers and capturing 2. Hezbollah said that the operation had been planned months ago and was unrelated to the Palestinians' demand for the release of Palestinian women and children imprisoned in Israeli jails. Hezbollah stated that it wants to trade the release of the 2 Israeli soldiers for the release of the Lebanese civilians held in Israeli jails. In response, Israel attacked with artillery and fighter jets. All runways of the Beirut airport were destroyed, as were two other airports, one in the Bekaa Valley and the other in northern Lebanon. Bridges, power stations, roads, including the major road from Beirut to Damascus, and water supplies were also destroyed. Prime Minister Olmert declared that he holds the government of Lebanon responsible for the Hezbollah attacks and warned that Israel's retaliation would be massive. "No place is safe," he said, a phrase that was repeated by Israel's current chief of staff, Dan Halutz, during an interview in the field with CNN. We should note here that Hezbollah, or the Party of God in Arabic, now branded by Israel and the United States as a terrorist organization, was founded when Israel invaded Lebanon to destroy the Palestinian leadership in June of 1982, precisely to repel the invasion and force Israel out of Lebanon. The government of Lebanon has no control over Hezbollah. Israel knows that fact but chooses to ignore it to justify its draconian assault on Lebanon. More than 82 Lebanese civilians have been killed so far. On Thursday, at a press conference in Germany with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, President Bush again repeated the time-worn "Israel has a right to defend itself" formula, although he accompanied it with a feeble recommendation to Israel to recognize that its beef is with Hezbollah and not with the government of Lebanon. Chancellor Merkel, however, urged the parties to declare a ceasefire and find ways to de-escalate tensions. United Nations Secretary Kofi Annan has sent a high-level crisis group of three people, headed by Ambassadors Alvaro de Soto and Terje Larsen, to visit Palestine, Israel, Syria, and Lebanon with a view to seeking a de-escalation of the conflict and finding diplomatic solutions. Also on Thursday, Israel imposed an air and sea blockade of Lebanon and struck southern Beirut. Two rockets were fired from Lebanon into the city of Haifa, wounding one person. This is the farthest Hezbollah rockets have struck into Israel. Hezbollah has denied firing these rockets, but has not denied retaliating for Israel's attack on the Lebanese civilian infrastructure by firing more than 180 other rockets, which hit Nahariya, Safed, Carmel, Meron, Tiberias, and other northern Israeli cities. Attacks in which 120 people were wounded and four people were killed, including a woman and her child. A U.S. Navy ship left Haifa, destination unknown at this point. A U.N. Security Council resolution decrying Israel's assault against Gaza was predictably vetoed by the United States, with four countries abstaining: the United Kingdom, Denmark, Slovakia, and Peru. On Friday, at an emergency U.N. Security Council meeting convened to discuss the crisis in Lebanon, Dan Gillerman, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, stated that Lebanon is occupied by terrorists and that Israel's military offensive would benefit Lebanon by freeing it to exercise its sovereignty over southern Lebanon and helping it to become the free, democratic, prosperous country it was before 1975. So, Mr. Gillerman would have us believe that Israel's military offensive is a beneficent war, certainly a first for the history books. In later comments, the ambassador claimed that the rockets fired into Israel were Iranian missiles fired by Hezbollah from civilian homes in Lebanon, and that Israel was only attacking Hezbollah strongholds. He also grouped together Hezbollah, Iran, Hamas, and Syria, calling it the Axis of Terror, and Syria the arch-terrorist. "We have heard the demonization of Syria and Iran and the linking of Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and Syria from many officials, former officials, analysts, and so-called media experts throughout much of this week. One can well speculate that this is part of a strategy to use Hezbollah as a backdoor to Syria and Iran and prepare the United States public for possible military action against them, as well as accept the possibility of Israel taking military action against them. While the United Nations and all the countries represented in the United Nations Security Council called for the lessening of tensions and the declaration of a ceasefire, the United States said it will not ask Israel to stop its military campaign against Lebanon. Israel's linkage of Hamas with Hezbollah also serves as justification for its refusal to negotiate with the Hamas government, its abduction of elected Hamas leaders, and its stated intention of killing Hamas members. We see Israel's use of disproportionate force as calculated to fire up a major crisis, to divert the world's attention away from the carnage in Gaza and the accelerated de facto annexation of large swaths of the West Bank, even if it means involving the world in a regional war, which it hopes will take Palestine off the table for good and end all efforts towards creating a sovereign Palestinian state. Yesterday, Israel directed its shelling to downtown Beirut and up and down the coast of Lebanon, including the Manara area close to Ras Beirut and the American University. At the G8 summit yesterday at St. Petersburg in Russia, President Bush again refused to ask Israel to stop its assault on Lebanon. Reports of more deaths and more destruction keep pouring in. The New York Times today reports that Israel attacked the northern ports of Tripoli and Jenin, and that one of Israel's attacks on a civilian convoy killed at least 16 Lebanese civilians, most of them children. The evolving situation in the Middle East is extremely dangerous. Reports of more and more human casualties. If no serious effort is made to defuse this conflict, the whole Middle East could be engulfed in a regional war, which could drag in the United States, presumably to defend its ally, with the possible use of nuclear weapons, as Israel had threatened to do during the 1973 war with Egypt, and as the United States was recently planning to use against hardened targets in Iran. Today, we are very pleased and honored to welcome Professor Ilan Pappe as our guest. Professor Pappe is director of the International Relations Division at Haifa University and the academic director of the Institute for Peace Research at Kivat Haviva, Israel. Dr. Pappe is the author of numerous articles and books, among them Britain and the Arab-Israeli Conflict, published in 1988, The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict from 1947 to 1951, published in 1992, and The Modern History of Israel and Palestine from 1840 to 1999. As Israel's leading new historian, Professor Pappe has been much maligned in his country for exposing Israel's history, much of which has been wiped out of the history books used in Israel. Efforts were also made to have Professor Pappe dismissed from the university in May of 2002. He joins us now by telephone link to Israel. Good afternoon, Dr. Pappe. Welcome to This Week in Palestine. And thank you for agreeing to this interview at a very difficult moment.
I think for the people of Lebanon, but also for the people who live now in northern Israel.
Sure. Well, what do you make of the current crisis, and what do you think are Israel's intentions and objectives?
I think that there is a general scheme, and there are also ad hoc reactions of the Israeli government that together fuse into what we see nowadays, both in Lebanon and in the Gaza Strip. And the most important thing is the general scheme, the general policy. And the general policy is a determination by the Israeli government to find the pretext for waging a full-scale war both against the Hamas in Gaza and in the West Bank on the one hand, and the Hezbollah in Lebanon on the other. The reason they want to go on with such a destructive policy is the basic ideology of the present government, that there is an historical moment because of the balance of power, the local balance of power or the regional balance of power, that would allow Israel unilaterally to impose its vision and its ideas over the whole of Palestine. And a very few obstacles on the way of implementing the unilateral Israeli policy. There are two main obstacles. One is the Hamas government and its resistance policies, and the other one is the Hezbollah in Lebanon. So they were looking for excuses for a while now in order to try and destroy these two forces so that they could go on implementing the plan. And this is the major plan. So it's really use of power in order to eliminate the two actors, very small actors, non-state actors, that you have here, as they have no problem, as you know, with the rest of the Arab world. The Arab regimes have long ago given up the struggle against Israel. And that's the grand scheme, if you want. I'm not sure that they knew exactly about the attack of the Hezbollah beforehand, or the abduction of the soldier in the south. And some of the reactions of the Israelis were ad hoc reactions. But very quickly, as in Gaza, so in Lebanon, the natural sort of reaction to an abduction of a soldier or two soldiers in the north turned into a full-scale war. And the full-scale war was pre-mediated, pre-prepared, and fits with the overall Israeli policy of unilaterally imposing its control over the whole of Palestine and reshaping the map in a way that would serve the long Zionist ideology of having as much of Palestine as possible, unfortunately with as few Palestinians as possible in it.
Professor Noam Chomsky had cautioned us all in a speech at the Harvard Business School not to examine the U.S. policy toward Israel without also understanding the global nature of U.S. policy. And part of that policy is control of the Middle East. So it appears that here we have a confluence of interests, of Israel's interest to gobble up the West Bank and impose its views, and America's interest in, or rather the Bush administration's interest in, controlling the Middle East under the guise of spreading democracy. It appears to me that the last thing the United States wants to have happen is to have oil-producing nations become strong democracies that can resist its hegemony. So that excuse apparently is just used for its presence in Iraq. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes. In fact, this explains why the only country in the world that once again unconditionally supports Israeli actions is the United States, and the United States has already vetoed a very reasonable and sensible United Nations resolution in the Security Council. Yes, I do think so. I don't think it really contradicts. I think you have the unilateral Israeli policy of imposing its will over Palestine and the neighboring countries, which fits hermetically with the hawkish policies of the United States in the Middle East. In many ways, the Israelis are implementing a certain chapter in the design of the American policymakers, as it was propagated by Donald Rumsfeld already in 2001, when he enumerated the states and the organizations which the Americans are considered as legal targets in America's so-called war on terror, and both the Hezbollah and the Hamas were on it. So in a way, when one had the impression that in Iraq the empire was doing the job for the proxy, one feels that maybe this is a payoff time, and Israel as a proxy acts here in the name of the empire. This, of course, adds impetus to the Israeli action, this also ensures Israel that the United States would give it the time it wants without any pressure from the outside world to pursue its policies, which are more or less the destruction of the Gaza Strip with the Hamas in it, and the destruction of as much of Lebanon as they can with the Hezbollah in it. The unfortunate thing is, of course, here in Israel, people are not aware of the American aspect, one should call it, of these policies, And this is really a sad beginning, because a sad warning, I'm sorry, because I think that if going back to Donald Rumsfeld's grand design plans in 2001 and 2002, it's very clear that there are others on this list, namely the Syrian government and Iran, and this may not be the end of it.
Yes, I remember there was the last phrase of a report that was put out by the Pentagon and was quoted on ABC News is this. It said, Iraq, the tactical. Saudi Arabia, the strategic. Egypt, the prize. And so it appears that this was in the blueprint a long time ago. But yet, as a regional war might set off the whole Middle East. All the Arab nations would be set afire in this. There is a real risk that nuclear weapons might be used. If Israel believes that it is in danger, as it did in 1973, and it had threatened using nuclear weapons at that time, and if the United States is dragged into this war to support its ally, and the United States wanted to attack Iran, and as President Bush had planned earlier, to use nuclear weapons on hardened Iranian targets, we are faced with a doomsday scenario. It appears to me that still Palestine is still the issue. It lingers on, and like a debt that has not been paid, it accumulates interest. And if it continues to be ignored, it'll accumulate penalties as well as interest that go even farther than the original debt. Penalties that will be exacted by more attacks on Americans and American interests abroad and in the United States, attacks on Europe and elsewhere. So this could be this could create a very dangerous world. Yet indeed, we are trying here to work toward securing some kind of peace. And the peace movements here in the United States and around the world need to pool their resources and develop strategies for effective action. The strategies depend on the particular countries. For example, in the United States, as you know, it is extremely difficult to move the government or the media away from their negative attitudes toward Palestinians. From your knowledge of the scene here and in Europe, what strategies and actions would you recommend following in the United States and in Europe?
Well, first of all, I think the analysis with which you prefaced this question is a very important one that should be conveyed very strongly and very clearly to the people in the United States, namely that this is not a local war in the north of Palestine. This is a conflict that has the potential of drawing in the region as a whole with conventional and non-conventional weapons, which means that its impact would be felt far beyond the borders of the Middle East, and in fact would harm almost irreversibly American interests as well as Western interests around the world. And I would add another layer to it, and I will come shortly to the main thrust of your question, that there is a great danger of research of anti-Semitism as a result of it, because when people would start to count the losses after the kind of a doomsday scenario you have described, or something similar, or even if it's not the whole of it, at least part of it, it would be Israel and the Jewish communities around the world that supported it. They would be blamed, especially in the United States, for dragging America into such destructive policies. So the implications are that indeed Jews and non-Jews around the West have a vested interest to try and curb and stop the aggressive Israeli policies, because in the long run, it will affect them, as it will affect, of course, the poor victims of this aggression here on the ground. Now, more practical things about what can be done in the United States with the peace movement. I think there are three major areas of activity which are important to explore, and we've done it in the past, but I don't think we have done it effectively enough. One is what you are doing in your own program, but should be extended, and this is an alternative source of information. From my trips around the United States, I found out that the main problem is not a hate to Palestinians or Arabs or a particular a love of Israel. It's a lot of ignorance. And the ignorance is not because people are ignorant, but because the main media in the United States misinforms them constantly ever since 1948, including in the year of the Nakba itself. And I think that whatever we can do to extend the alternative information channels would bring good people who are not with us now to join us in the struggle. So that's one area. The second area is always the changing, what I call usually the urgent agenda. Of course, that's very difficult to follow, I admit. I mean, 2 weeks ago we would have asked to recruit people to stop the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. Now we have to also recruit them to try and stop the destruction of Lebanon. But I think it really is a very tough struggle against the shapers of policy in the United States, but there's no other way of doing it. By proving to the American public opinion as much as one can through whatever means that there is an urgent need to stop the Israeli aggression, and that the United States can do it by not stopping the veto effort in the United Nations, by pressuring Europeans, that's more the job of the European NGOs, by pushing the European countries to adopt a policy of their own. I'm not very optimistic about it, but I do feel that maybe we need to, again, try and coordinate in kind of a lobby group the action that try and point to the fact that every passing day more dangers are coming out. There is a more dangerous situation that can develop from the escalation in the war itself. And in the long run, I think it's so difficult to do it here, so it could be very helpful if people could do it from the outside, is to expose, maybe that's more the role of academics and journalists who have time to write more deeper articles, but and this is for workshop and educational enterprise. I really think we have to teach people from scratch what has happened in Palestine in the last 60 years. I think so many Americans don't understand the nature of Zionism, its connection to colonialism, the nature between ethnic ideologies that the State of Israel holds and its policies. Its policies in the past and its policies today are all part of an ethnic cleansing ideology. And I think these, the more Israelis and the more Jews would do it, the better, but even if they cannot do it, or someone else should do it. There is a need to re-educate people of the grand scheme of things, of the larger picture, because otherwise the Israeli propaganda would always be able to tell the average American, what do you want from us? Would you not attack Mexico if Texas would have been bombarded by missiles? Which is a logical kind of an Israeli statement. But of course, if you know the history, you understand why the Katyushas are flying over the border. And I think there's a lot to be done there. I'm not sure we have, and I say it about myself and everyone else, I'm not saying we haven't tried to do it in the United States, but I feel that we haven't coordinated our work and we haven't put our best efforts into it as yet.
Dr. Papa, I'd like to explore with you something here. You hit upon a very important point earlier in which you mentioned rising anti-Semitism. And I think that the Jewish diaspora, which supports blindly anything Israel does, including war crimes and everything else, is making itself vulnerable to criticism, which is then branded as anti-Semitism and continues the cycle. And Israel's actions have always been put within the context of existential battles. And that also preys upon Jews' deepest fears of annihilation. Israel is not accountable to anyone except the Jews. And it seems to me that the diaspora ought to become a lot more involved in Israel's affairs and policies. And if the diaspora were more involved and saw that Israel is today one of the most dangerous places for a Jew to live in, that they would at least try to change those policies. Do you agree with this, and how do you think can the diaspora get involved?
Yes, I fully agree. I think that, in fact, one of the reasons that the Israelis are yet immune from any serious criticism, or as you have put it, that they behave as if they're not accountable to anyone, is, of course, the memory of the Holocaust, the terrible Holocaust that happened to the Jews in Europe. And I think what we can see now is some cracks in this wall of immunity, where young, very few, but it's a good beginning of young Jewish of organization of young Jews in the United States understand what their parents didn't understand, that actually that the legacy of the Holocaust was to resist such policies as the one that are pursued by Israel. In fact, you would have expected Jews to be at the forefront of demonstrations against Israel because of that terrible collective memory, and as they were at the forefront of demonstrations for civil rights in the southern United States and against apartheid in South Africa. So first of all, I hope that this is the beginning of such NGOs, and I'm connected to them because they write to all of us, would be more significant. So definitely there is even the beginning of an alternative, of course, not strong enough. But I do agree. I think that the only reason some very intelligent and sensitive people in the world who knows what's going on here are not yet putting a pressure on Israel and in fact trying to stop its policies is this manipulative connection that Israel established between what happened in Europe in the Second World War and the fate of the Jews in the world today. If we will be able to show people that in fact the most dangerous thing that can happen to the Jewish communities around the world after the Holocaust is the continuation of the Zionist policies and the Israeli policies. And I think that this is a very important message because it shows you that for people like myself, the struggle is not just for the sake of Palestinians or Muslims or Christians. Of course, it includes also struggle for Jews, for myself, for my family, for my friends here. The few millions of people who now live in the land of Palestine and the millions of refugees that should return to it can easily form a heaven on earth here. There's no need in the summer of 2006 for people to butcher each other here. The problem is that where you are broadcasting from, the political system and media system tends to blame Islam or Islamic movement or the Arab world for that reality, where it's very easy from here to see that the only obstacle between very normal life in a very beautiful part of the world and the realization of that dream are the policies of the state of Israel. And the public opinion and the civil society around the world has proved to us once in the case of South Africa that it has the power to force governments to change policies in order to pariah South Africa and to make a fundamental change there. I think the power and the energy is already there with regard to Israel and Palestine. But let's hope that the people would be organized before it would be too late, because the destructive power of Israel is far stronger than that of South Africa and the white regime in South Africa, and the implications here are far more explosive than there was the case in the apartheid regime.
Yes, I mean, it seems to me that the leadership, the Israeli leadership, ought to be made accountable to the diaspora, because like no other nation, the Israeli leaders are not only governing the state of Israel, but are supposed to be stewards for future generations. And their failure to do so and their putting the diaspora at risk is something for which they must be held accountable. Otherwise, the kind of anti-Semitism which can arise will make the anti-Semitism of the Middle Ages seem like a picnic. We could have something like a modern version of the Protocols of Zion, and this would be unfortunate and extremely painful. I do hope, but I'm told that most of the young Jews in the United States really don't have much of a connection with Israel, and that the middle generation still is under control of the established Jewish organizations, which also use their fear of the past as a way of making sure that they toe the line and support Israel. Unfortunately, I don't see much of an action in this direction. And I do wish somehow that it would take hold. What can we do from here? I think you have... Now, the Israeli peace movement, does it exist anymore, or has it all but disappeared at this point?
Well, there is a small nucleus of people who are definitely a genuine peace camp in Israel. They're brave people, and they're committed people, and in the last 2 days, in almost an impossible atmosphere of total consensus, and sort of a war atmosphere, they even staged two very brave demonstrations against the Israeli actions in Lebanon, and a week before they demonstrated against the Israeli destruction of the Gaza Strip. But they're very, very small in numbers, and they have very little ability to influence public opinion from within, definitely when it comes to changing current policies or near-future policies. I think they will be very instrumental in trying and build a long-term alternative, and there lies their importance. Now, I think that the hope we have, as I pointed before, is really... we pin our hopes on the civil societies around the world, and particularly in the United States, and as you mentioned yourself, particularly on the Jewish community in the United States. I know it sounds quite bizarre to you, it may sound bizarre to your listeners, but I really